on air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app.
This is the Country Hour with Megan Hughes on ABC Radio Queensland.
Good afternoon. Thanks for your company today. So Australia's red meat industry has dropped its goal of being carbon neutral by 2030, saying it's not achievable. I've spoken about this on the Country Hour last week, and also I know Callie spoke about it on Monday as well. But the question is, where next for Meat and Livestock Australia? Because MLA has actually been the driving force of this target since about 2017, and it says it's spent over $100 million on initiatives to help the industry reach the goal. This week, it released its latest five-year strategy, and it includes this noticeable shift away from the CN30 target. Matt Brand spoke to MLA's Managing Director, Michael Crowley, about what led to this decision.
Over the last 12 months, we've consulted heavily with industry. We've gone very broad and deep in our consultation around our strategic plan. In parallel to that process, there was also a midpoint review of the industry strategic plan, Red Meat 2030. I think through the course of that 12 months, we saw that there was concern about retaining a goal that all of the data says that we weren't going to achieve carbon neutrality by 2030, despite all of the great investments that we have made and continue to make that will drive our net position in a positive way. So we, as a company, decided to remain aligned with the meat industry strategic plan, Red Meat 2030. And through that discussion with the industry representatives, there was a decision made to move from CN30 to aligning with the national net zero ambitions that didn't exist when CN30 was first envisioned.
Michael, you said MLA consulted heavily to get to this moment. Is that what was lacking perhaps back in 2017 when CN30 was first born?
Well, I think that 2017 was a very different time in that we saw this as a real emerging trend that our industry would need to respond to. And the language in 2017 was the industry can be carbon neutral by 2030. It changed the investment landscape significantly when CN30 became part of the meat industry strategic plan, which commenced in 2020. That was really when we were able to scale up the investments, particularly through the MLA donor company, which has been about 80% of the investment.
Yeah, sorry, Michael, just on the question, do you think the red meat industry wanted that back in 2017? Just going off a few conversations I've had with cattle producers this morning, they just felt no one was actually asking for it back then.
I think it was one of those insight-led visions that we could be carbon neutral by 2030. It was disruptive. It was designed to be disruptive. And it was through the development of Red Meat 2030 that was where the discussions were held about whether it becomes part of the industry plan. And it was adopted as part of the industry plan after that initial disruptive period.
Has it been MLA's biggest R&D spend over recent years?
It hasn't. I would say our genetics program is the largest proportion of our investment. We've certainly seen more growth in our sustainability investments, particularly around CN30. We've invested over $100 million over the last 5 years. But we've also scaled up our investments in productivity-driven investments. We've really scaled up, more than doubled our investment in producer adoption and trying to move from from R&D into adoption and commercialisation across a whole range of investments we make, from genetics through the on-farm production system, objective measurement technologies and beyond.
You mentioned there's been about $100 million spent on this target. I've got a press release from MLA in 2023, Jason Strong, saying that since 2017, MLA has invested about $200 million and we're looking to invest a further $150 million.
So I think there was a, maybe it's a slight adjustment in the language, but I've looked at from 2020 to 2025 was over $100 million of investment.
So perhaps since 2017 it could be close to $200
million? Oh, I don't think it was that high, Matt. Yeah. There was certainly, we identified very early on that investment required to get to CN30 would be closer to $250 million. But we now have the zero net emissions for agriculture, CRC, getting off the ground.
Mm.
And the livestock component of the CRC lines up directly with the key priorities in our roadmap to get to CN30. So we're really only here in 2025 getting the additional leverage, and ability to move from R&D into adoption and commercialization in this space. So we've done the heavy lifting on getting those investments off the ground. And then I think that we are moving very much into adoption and commercialization of the technologies that have been developed to date. And our core funding that we'll be responsible for outside of the CRC will focus on the biogenic methane cycle, productivity-driven sustainability investments, as we build on methane as a trait in our genetic evaluation, the feed supplements that have been developed across a whole range of technologies that are looking really promising, as well as the
on that though, what do you think the appetite is for feeding seaweed to cattle now that this target is no longer there?
I still think there's going to be strong demand from supply chains and customers that are really wanting to demonstrate significant progress on reducing emissions of their supply chain. And we will continue to measure under the National Greenhouse Gas Inventory, Australia's red meat and livestock contribution to the National Greenhouse Gas Inventory. So we are still committed to measuring our progress every year, as we have done through CSIRO's report against the 2005 baseline. So there will still be very much that customer pull-through demand for these technologies moving forward.
Last week, John McKillop from the Red Meat Advisory Council told the Country Hour that MLA now needs to come up with an intensity model and that you've got 12 months to do this. Can you explain to us what that is and what it might look like?
There are two key strategic plan KPIs under our environmental sustainability area. So one of them is measuring our contribution against the National Greenhouse Gas Inventory, which is our net zero number, and we'll continue to report that. The other component, when we look at productivity-driven sustainability and having a more efficient supply chain and production system, is measuring emissions intensity per kilo of production. So we will be developing a baseline for that measure and continuing to report our emissions intensity moving forward and making meaningful progress in reducing our emissions intensity per kilo of production. To me, that is quite a significant step forward in recognising a more efficient production system, more fertile animals, more feed efficient, reducing days to slaughter, getting animals to market faster will all contribute to the emissions intensity number.
MLA's Managing Director, Michael Crolley there. And you can find MLA's new five-year strategic plan on its website. So head there if you want to check it out. But he made some pretty interesting comments there, especially on whether Mr. Crolley thinks there'll be demand about feeding seaweed to cattle in the future. And he does think there'll still be demand on the market for low emissions beef. A lot of work and a lot of research has been done on feeding Asparagopsis seaweed to cattle. That red seaweed really has been shown that when it is fed to cattle as a supplement, it reduces methane emissions from them. But without set emissions targets for the industry, the question is, will anyone still be buying it? Dr. Adam Main is the head of external relations at CH4 Global Incorporated, and they've opened an Asparagopsis facility in South Australia. He believes there'll still be strong demand going forward.
No, look, I think the targets set by the industry association, MLA, and the other associations representing those people that are farming out there in Australia, They exist, and those goals are big, ambitious goals, because they have to show the industry what they're aiming for, where the industry should be going to meet that international standard that is, you know, happening around us right now. So there's absolutely a place for the MLAs to push for those types of goals and to offer support for all the farmers out there to try and achieve those goals. And I think that, you know, reality does come in sometimes. And if there's a need to review and adjust, then people like us at CH4 that are working on those climate change technologies are happy to work with MLA and all the other associations to see what is a realistic goal and how can we work together, both types of industry, the ones that are producing the supplements and also the cattle industry, to achieve those targets.
Well, with those ambitious goals in place, does that give though more incentive to the industry and to producers to take up products like Asparagopsis without that sort of target? Does it take or hinder any of the uptake of that?
Yeah, I think that those overarching MLA goals give something to aim at. But within the industry, there's always those early adopters or innovators that are going to move faster than the rest of the industry. So for our goal in Australia was to find those early movers or those early adopters and work with them and in a way support what MLA are trying to achieve for the broader industry by showing case studies of how it can be done. But, you know, with that said, it is sometimes necessary to change the goals. I'm just pleased that they haven't moved away from still trying to achieve those goals. They just might have to do it in a slightly different way. The worst case scenario is if they moved away from them and said, we're not going down that path anymore. That would be a problem.
With those goals still in perhaps less ambitious, but still there in some form, do you see products like what CH4 makes, your Asparagopsis, still being part of that mix?
I think it's even more important now, because the message has been sent out to the public and to the farming community. This is a big task to take on. And I don't think the farmers should be left to try and work this all out on their own. So now is the time for better collaboration between those who are farming, those who are leading the charge in regards to trying to address the climate change issue on farm with their life cycle assessments and their carbon reduction activities. But we also then need to bring in those that are enabling technology like Asparagopsis, one of the ones that CH4 is obviously focusing on. How do we try to get that demonstrated within the industry so people can feel like there is progress being made? So I think now is the time to have a bit of a rethink, a reevaluate, and a little bit of forced collaboration, because we are going to need to set new goals and stick to them.
As you said earlier, you're aiming for those sort of early adopters to take up this with early producers looking to take this up as early adopters. With those who have taken it up, I mean, is it because there was a target that the industry was looking to meet, or are they more early adopting because, you know, they have an interest in reducing emissions, target or no target?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. I think that whenever you're in an industry, and I've come from the fishing and aquaculture industry, and we've had ambitious targets there as well, it's always good to have that industry-wide target. It's actually quite unifying. And it was one of the things that we were really pleased about while building this, you know, our technology in Australia, is knowing that the industry association, the one that represents all of its members, had the vision, had the strategy to set a target to bring the industry along on that journey. So I always encourage that. I think the early movers and adopters were influenced by that, absolutely. But then the ones that are out there doing things right now also have seen that market access in an export market, market access in a domestic market, the change and shifts of consumers' behaviour and attitudes towards meat and dairy, they're already seeing that that's coming through in the way that our products are sold and the demand that's being generated for these new low carbon footprint options in the marketplace.
I think the last we heard from CH4 was the opening of your phase one of your Louth Bay site, the expected growth or targets of that site. This doesn't change any of that going forward?
No. It's all hands on deck at the moment, and I was just sort of amusing to myself the other day. 5 years in for me with this company, and the amount of seaweed that we're producing in a day was something that we dreamt about 5 years ago in producing in a year. So the scaling up that we've been able to achieve in 5 years is dramatic. And right now, we're still pleased to say that the demand and the breadth of that demand in Australia for trialing and understanding supplements is still high. So it's up to us now to get our skates on and get as much material as we can, because there is that demand here in the Australian ecosystem, the cattle and the dairy ecosystem.
The way that you sell it to potential customers or producers going forward, does that change now, though? I guess if you are talking about something that is an additional cost for producers, especially in a tough environment, if we're talking for producers down south in drought, to add an additional cost without that target there, does this, though, then change the approach or the marketing that you do to get people on board?
Yeah, look, I think that it was one of the earliest sort of comments we made on in the media was we can't create a technology that creates a cost for the farmer. So if someone's doing it tough, we're not expecting them to take you to be an early adopter of our technology while we're working out, you know, all the details. But they need to be having a watching brief. I think that how we supply material in 2025 will be different to 2026. And I think for as we grow with our scale, as we grow with our existing partners and get all the data that shows the efficacy and how, you know, how we are integrating our product into their normal day-to-day practices, I think we'll be ready by, you know, the 2026-27s to actually attract in a lot more of those people that might not be an early mover. So it's kind of exciting how we will shift our focus from those champions in the industry to the broader industry over the next few years. And I think that the value proposition will become a lot clearer by the end of this year.
That was Head of External Relations at CH4 Global Incorporated, Dr. Adam Main, speaking with Selena Green. Gomez from Umundi has texted in on the text line today. He said, "Hi, Megan. I thought the methane reduction from seaweed use increased meat production in the cattle. If that's the case, surely it would be useful feed additive regardless of climate change." From what I understand, Gomez, yes, the CSIRO did say that there is a strong indication that it does increase livestock productivity, but I think a lot of the research was around methane reduction. If anyone has any other information as well, you can text me on 0487 993 222. It is 22 minutes past 12. Up next, have you been struggling to find Australian pork? I'll have more on that soon.
ABC Breakfast. There's never been a better way to start your day. We're local like you, and we'll be right here every weekday when the sun rises. Join us for breakfast weekday mornings on ABC Local Radio.
On your radio, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Australians love their pork, eating almost 700,000 tons of it in 2023 alone. Now, all fresh pork in Australia is locally sourced, and that is thanks to some pretty strict biosecurity laws. But when it comes to cured cuts, like ham or bacon, a lot of it is actually frozen imported meat. Now, I'm curious to hear from you today about whether you've been struggling to buy Aussie ham or bacon. You can send me a text on 0487 993 222. I've heard from a few people now that they've been struggling to find it in the shops and on supermarket shelves. And pork imports are at a two-year high. Australian Pork Limited Chief Executive Margot Andre says a small choice at the deli can make a big difference to their industry.
So a lot of customers would note that when they go into the supermarkets and go looking for ham and bacon, that the availability of Australian ingredients is not there. We've often had this struggle with imported versus Australian, and initially it was to do with price. So the cost of production between Australian homegrown pork, which does have higher standards, whether it's employment costs or just regulations or things like that, did make that difference in price. We did see that the imported products who have different production methods did have a lower cost. What we've seen lately is that that gap is actually falling. So what we're moving to now as an industry is how do we start to rebuild that supply chain confidence and availability for Australian products to be in there. A lot of people would not be aware that when they look at a product and it's got the green triangle and the kangaroo, they often think they're buying Australian, and they're actually not. They need to look at the bar chart underneath. The fuller the bar, the more Aussie they are, is the line that we're trying to get out to consumers. And that's not only pork products, that's all of your beautiful Australian homegrown products. So we are working very tirelessly to raise that awareness so that our Australian consumers actually know to ask for Aussie grown, and through that we hope to be able to build the demand for Australian ingredients in our ham and bacon. Pork as a whole is actually growing, so whilst we haven't gone up in the amount of percentage-wise, we're sitting at 25.5% of ham and bacon is Australian ingredients and Aussie homegrown. Pork consumption as a whole has actually gone up about 3.2% over the past 12 months, which is fantastic. If you think about the pig as a whole, it goes to different parts for different things. So you can't just grow a bacon pig or just grow a ham pig. So it's about that whole of carcass utilization. And so, yes, the herd side has been growing, but also so has the population. So the request for our beautiful pork products is growing as well. So if you match them, even though we're growing slightly as a herd size, the demand for pork as a whole is growing as well. So that's where we still have that gap of around that sort of 75-ish approximate percent is ham and is imported. The actual pool that we're operating in has grown.
Going into one supermarket chain, they do seem to still have their own brand product that's Australian pork. Not all of the supermarkets do have that.
So it comes down to the supermarkets. We're quite a stable industry. So that supermarket would have either a connection into farms or a connection direct with the farm. Pigs for bacon and ham would be available anywhere around the country, depending on the request from the buyer. Really. So if the buyer is actually saying to the farmers, we would like you to supply a certain number of tons per week for ham and bacon, the farmers can absolutely do that. But it's not a tap that you just turn on and just turn off. So there has to be long-term commercial agreements in place that allow the farmer to actually sustainably add that extra meat into what they're doing on farm, into their production.
If you were just speaking to a consumer who didn't have a great deal of knowledge about the production, how would you summarise that for the consumer?
Our approach is that if consumers can start to understand to look for Australian, that increases the demand for Australian grown, which then gives businesses confidence to seek out Australian ingredients and gives our farmers confidence to put the extra pigs on to start to supply that chain. So it's actually starts with an awareness that then drives demand, that then drives that confidence. So I guess I encourage, which I do when I go into the supermarkets, is actually when I'm looking for my ham and bacon, is going up to the deli and asking, do you have Australian ham and bacon? And hoping that more and more people actually start to ask for that. I'm not saying don't buy ham and bacon, like still buy your ham and bacon. But if the Australian is available, what we'd like to do is for people to start purchasing that and requesting that, and eventually demand encourages supply.
Australian Pork Limited Chief Executive Margot Andre speaking to Brandon Long. Carol has texted in and said that it's not hard to find Australian pork here, that they are in the neighbour's cane paddock daily. Thanks for texting in, Carol. Also curious to know that if you are struggling to find it on supermarket shelves. I'm not sure if the feral pigs wandering around in cane paddocks are actually turned into pork products. But you can send me a text on 0487 993 222. Up next, a look at the future of produce packaging.
On your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Since it was invented in the 1950s, we've really embraced the convenience of plastic to the point where it's causing some damage to the environment. According to the Australian Packaging Covenant Organisation, or APCO, the peak industry body for the packaging sector, Australia generates more plastic waste per capita than every other country in the world apart from Singapore. Targets to phase out single-use plastic packaging by 2025 were set, but they were not met. As Jennifer Nichols discovered at a convention for the horticulture industry in Brisbane, designing fully compostable, fit-for-purpose packaging can take dozens of prototypes to get right.
So Rachel Chambers is the CEO of Queensland Fruit and Vegetable Growers. So fascinating to see the developments in packaging to try to get away from plastics. What are you being told by those in the industry?
2025 was a cutoff for some of the packaging's content. So I think it's from next year that you have to have a percentage of recycled content, etc., in packaging. That now is changing the face of what we are seeing here today with packaging apples or packaging strawberries and those kind of things. What I have worked out is probably three things. Is one, the packaging still has to have windows for consumers. So consumers, I don't know how you shop, but consumers still are picking up fruit, looking at fruit, turning fruit around, making sure that the quality is there. You know, one of the things that we've learned today is the package has to go through at speed, so we can't lose any of those production elements. So of course plastic is obviously more slippery slidey in those things and goes through very fast, whereas cardboard, there's edges and there's things like that which is actually slowing things down, so it has to go through it at speed as well. There's a sustainability element, and of course there's still cost to the grower.
Yeah, I've been really interested to go into the supermarkets lately and noticing grapes in cardboard containers, but there's still an element of plastic inside those. I guess you've got that challenge of moisture coming from fruit.
The actual science behind making sure that fruit is safe, it, you know, doesn't have mold, tamper-proof, making sure that other consumers haven't touched the stuff that you're going to go home and eat, all of those things is actually a science in itself, and that's what you're seeing here today.
But we have to take those steps forward because we've got way too much plastic in the world. More plastic put out in the last 10 years than from when plastic was invented. So that just boggles the mind.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's definite standards in place to push a shift in industry, and this has been coming for a while, and they have learnt to reuse plastic, they've learnt to change the plastics that they're using. So it is a continuous improvement package. At the same time, consumers, as you say, want non-smushed, non-tampered, pretty packaging on the other end. So it's a bit of a balance.
Let's have a look up here. Okay, so there they've got a packaging machine. They've got a new version of the old orange mesh fruit bag.
So, but it's got no metal clip. So you can see here, so this machine, 100% recyclable mono material, 50% less plastic, no metal clip. So it looks like the same thing you've been getting in store forever, but it's actually not. So this is the kind of things that consumers may not see change in the supermarket, but the actual content has changed.
So here you've got an example. So that's strawberries and blueberries in the cardboard packaging.
So I like this. My window is made from trees.
Hello. So I've got Peter Lloyd from Opal Packaging in front of us while we check out what he's doing. So how sustainable is this? Tell us about this.
So we've got a cardboard-based panel. So we've got a cellulose window in here. So the cellulose is basically a product that's derived from wood fibre pulp. Yep. Essentially, this is fully recyclable, so no need to separate. Plastic, often, obviously, you have plastic and you need to separate, put the fibre-based component into the yellow bin and then the plastic into the red. whereas obviously we've done the testing with these, and the value proposition here is around it, just basically put it all together as one unit into the yellow bin.
You know the good thing? I can already smell the strawberries.
You can smell it.
I can smell it, so it doesn't even need to be open, and I know they're good.
Excellent.
And so how widely is this being used now?
So a lot of these sort of categories, essentially the progression away from plastic is fairly new. And so look, these are sort of a new development we've only just recently brought out for the strawberries. So we've been working with the Osberry team in this space lately.
And how long has it taken? How many prototypes to get to here?
I don't know how many. We've been working on this for a little while, to be honest, yeah. A few years, yeah.
And you've got blueberries in there too?
We do. We've been working on blueberry space. So but I work with the team at Mountain Blue in Eureka, and basically have had these in the market for a little while.
That's Peter Lloyd from Opal Packaging. Okay, on the packaging front, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Bernie Dillon from OG Fibre Solutions. We have been working on apple punnet for Woolworths, who are the ones pushing the product, who want to change from a flow wrap, the plastic around the outside of a punnet, to just a punnet with either a sticker or a band. These are our samples, our design. We've been asked by a company in Sydney to have a look at the Opal punnet that's out there and redesign it so it will suit their machine better.
So that pretty much to me looks like a miniature version of a cardboard fruit box.
That's correct, yes.
That you would deliver fruit to in grocery stores.
Yeah.
Okay, yes. And so how far along are you in?
They had 27 designs done up until this point. This is the 28th design that we've come in with. So I will meet with the guys today. This will go back to Sydney. They will put it through a machine next week. And then they will come back to me if they need any adjustments done to suit their machine. It's got to sit in a crate properly. To get the design right is difficult because you're trying to fit it into a certain size crate that both Woolworths, Aldi and Coles use.
And so have you got any plastic in this?
No plastic whatsoever.
Got holes in the side though?
Holes in the side, so you'll be able to visually see the fruit through the holes.
That report from Jen Nichols. And next I'll get the latest in the weather with the Bureau of Meteorology.
Hi, I'm Andy Lee.
And that's Wiz.
It's not.
And we'd love you to check out the new ABC Family show from my book series.
Do not watch this show.
Make sure you're not watching Friday, July 4 on ABC iView.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
And it's time to have a check-in on the weather. Baden Gilbert joins me now from the Bureau of Meteorology. Good afternoon, Baden.
Good afternoon.
I can see there's still a lot of wind warnings about right across the state. Can you give me the latest, please?
Yes, I can indeed. So we do still have a bunch of wind-related warnings out. The first main one is that severe weather warning, which is for parts of the elevated terrain and also just the eastern side of those slopes about the main range, down towards the Granite Belt, as well as about the scenic rim. So there will be a risk in that area until sometime tomorrow of winds of around up to 55 to 65 kilometres an hour, with potential for gusts of up to around 100 kilometres per hour, which is why we have that warning out. We also do have a sheep grazers warning still out for the Eastern Downs. That's primarily for the early hours of the morning. We already had that risk during this morning. And then there's also a bunch of marine wind warnings for much of the southeast coast from Gurry southwards. So plenty of wind-related stuff out there.
Could you run me through, have there been any big observations of wind gusts or anything this morning so far?
Yeah, for sure. So we've had some gusts up to around 65 kilometres an hour at Toowoomba, up around that 55 to 60 kilometre metre. Sorry, try that again. 55 to 60 kilometre per hour mark at Kingaroy. And we also have a portable weather station out near Crow's Nest, which is observing some mean winds of around that 55 kilometre an hour mark, with the gusts only sitting just a little bit above that. And we also observe some gusts up at Applethorpe near Stanthorpe in the Granite Belt, which is seeing gusts around that 55 kilometre an hour mark too. The other thing to note is that the combination of those winds with the temperatures we had this morning about the eastern downs through to the Granite Belt, it was a minimum temperature of around as low as about 2 degrees in some places, but when you mix in the wind on top of that, the feels like temperature definitely went below zero for places like Toowoomba, like Stanthorpe, with even getting as low as -5, that feels like temperature during the early hours of this morning. So definitely feeling freezing, even if it wasn't quite freezing by the thermometer.
Definitely. What about in coastal waters? We spoke briefly about the wind warnings, but what else is happening around the coast?
Yeah, so along the coast, there is still some mild gusts around as you go further north, around the Capricornia coast and places like that. But broadly across northern Queensland and far north Queensland, the winds are actually lightening from what we've had earlier this week. And we are going to see some relatively benign conditions further north with wind broadly in a southerly wind flow coming off the land rather than that usual southeasterly trade flow off the ocean we get on the east coast for much of the year.
And I'll just go across the border. What is the latest on the situation in New South Wales?
So in New South Wales, we do still have a severe weather warning current for them for winds in the north, as well as that risk along the coastal fringe from about Newcastle down towards the Victorian border, as well as some of the elevated peaks down towards Victoria. They've had quite a lot of wind gusts in that part of the world and also quite a lot of rain with totals in excess of 200 millimetres about the Illawarra Escarpment, which is definitely quite notable for that part of the world. The low is still sitting there spinning away just off the mid-north coast and is expected to linger during today before moving off into the Tasman into tomorrow.
And how much longer are we expecting sort of in Queensland for these conditions to continue? Are they easing later this week?
Yes, that's right. So we still have that wind risk for Wednesday, and that will continue overnight into Thursday. As that low moves off into the Tasman, we do get a slackening of the pressure gradient, which leads to an easing of the winds across southeast Queensland. So we're expecting a lot of those warnings to be cancelled during Thursday, and we'll have much more benign conditions across not just the southeast, but the entire state for Friday, with only, those cooler temperatures probably going to be the focus in terms of weather for the next couple of days.
What about into the weekend? How's that looking?
Yeah, so into this weekend, we do have a very weak cloud band that's going to form about the central coast on Saturday, late Saturday into Sunday. Totals are expected to be pretty low, though, like sort of around that 10 to 20 millimetre mark at most, but it will lead to a bit of a cloudier weekend from places around Townsville, south along the coast, and also extending inland a little bit, potentially extending towards as far as the Sunshine Coast for Sunday before it all clears off again on Monday, and we just have that remnant risk of showers about the Northern Cape by the time we get in towards early next week.
Baden, thank you so much for your time today.
Have a good one.
You too. Baden Gilbert, Senior Forecaster from the Bureau of Meteorology.
Every day, all around Australia, extraordinary people create moments that inspire. See them, hear them. All you have to do is nominate them at australianoftheyear.org.au.
Tomorrow is Giving Day, so we're asking you to help your fellow Queenslander farmers and communities who lost everything during the recent flooding events. For more information, text DONATE to 0487 993 222.
So it has been a pretty rough start to the year for a lot of Queensland farmers. There's been back-to-back disasters that have brought pretty heartbreaking scenes of flooded rural communities. It's something that we've been speaking about on the Country Hour this year a lot. Tomorrow, we're inviting you to help Queensland farmers and communities recover through the work of Rural Aid as part of ABC Queensland Gives. Now, your donation will contribute to a suite of services, things like practical on-farm cleanup assistance, hayfeed for livestock, ongoing mental health support, and even repairs of infrastructure and community events to reduce isolation and foster hope. Then, from 6:30 tomorrow night, ABC Radio Queensland Evening's Kelly Higgins Devine and ABC North Queensland's Adam Stephen will host a special Rock the Recovery concert. And that'll feature music from country rock legends Halfway, fabulous Jem Casadaley, the hilarious Jenny Winter, and the brilliant Australian Army Band. Farmers, the backbone of our state. So join with us tomorrow for ABC Queensland Gives Day on ABC Radio Queensland.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
I had a few texts come through while I was speaking to Baden from the Bureau of Meteorology about our earlier story on about whether or not people are struggling to get Australian pork products at the moment. Liza has texted in saying that she gets very frustrated at the lack of Australian ham and bacon on supermarket shelves and that she refuses to buy non-Australian products. And that she wants to support our local producers. And for this reason, she buys ham and bacon from the local butcher. And that she said the supermarkets have a role of responsibility to play as well. And they should be highlighting and promoting Australian grown ham and bacon products in the deli and on the shelves, rather than just pushing products based purely on cost. David has also messaged in saying that he purchases wild boar and pig and other wild meats online, and they are 100% Australian products. Thank you so much for your texts today. If you want to join the conversation on the Country Hour, you can send me a text on 0487 993 222. To our next story now. When you think of wheat, what sort of products come to mind? Maybe it's flour, cereal, bread, pasta even. Would you think now about t-shirts or jeans or a dress? Because your high-fiber diet could also become high fashion, as Liam McNally reports.
The grains behind some of your favourite breakfast cereals could one day be an even bigger part of your morning routine, thanks to new research out of Europe. Scientists at Chalmers University in Sweden have discovered a way to turn wheat straw and oat husks into energy and resource-efficient clothing. Senior researcher Diana Bernan explains how.
So my research is basically focused on to develop new processes which are energy efficient and resource efficient, you know, like using, for example, side streams instead of using the virgin material. Because we have so many side streams and often they are piled up somewhere. And so I'm looking into and see if they can be used in a different way. So when you make textile fibers currently, it's a cellulose pulp, you know, like similar to the pulp that you make paper of. So it's basically like cellulose fibers, but you cannot spin them into a textile fiber. So you first have to dissolve it and then you coagulate to make the fibers. Instead of using like virgin trees, if we can use other streams, for example, like the oat husks or the wheat straws, they have that have already a lot of cellulose inside, if you can use those to make this dissolving pulp.
Have you gotten to feel what the final product is like compared to, say, a cotton material?
Yeah, so I think it's very similar because it's the same cellulose, you know, it's the same, chemistry-wise, it's the same molecule inside.
Diana Bernan from Chalmers University in Sweden. Western Australia and New South Wales produce more than half of Australia's wheat, with South Australia, Victoria and Queensland making up the rest. At Kilcummin in central Queensland, Bradley Misford's family has farmed for generations. Producing in one of the most northern growing regions, he uses wheat straw to protect his soil. He says farmers like him wouldn't give it up lightly.
Currently, it's one of the biggest assets of the crop. We're taking the seed, obviously, off the top, and leaving the stubble standing. And that's a big benefit for erosion. That stops a lot of erosion and helps capture water because the water can't, you know, it's not running away down the creek. It's getting held up and going into the soil. My personal opinion is it's too valuable standing in the paddock for us. And I'm only speaking for this northern Queensland region, I guess. And I don't have a lot of experience, you know, in southern Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria. And I know their crops are a lot bigger. It could be something that's, you know, beneficial to them guys. But I don't see it being something that's going to work or be viable here.
Australian wheat is coveted overseas for its high quality as a food source, but could it also become a source of natural fabric? At Deakin University's Institute for Frontier Materials, Associate Professor Chris Hurren's lab is working to develop the next generation of sustainable textiles. He says if the cellulose coming from wheat and oats is pure, it would be worth exploring here.
The quest for alternative fibres has been around since pre-war, if you look at it. That's how we ended up with nylon and then polyesters and polypropylenes and things like that. Now the quest is for alternative environmentally sourced fibres, so fibres that are coming from waste feedstocks or feedstocks that are renewable. 65 to 70% of the world textiles are from polyester, and that's totally from oil. So if, as the oil depletes, we've got to find an alternative source for that. Now, cotton makes up about 25% of the world textiles, and wool's making up about 1% of the apparel textiles and about 2% of the total textiles. So even if we triple wool production, which would pretty much put a sheep on every bit of land in Australia, there's no way wool's ever going to make it up. We're pretty much growing cotton on every bit of land that we can grow cotton on, so cotton's not going to be the one that's going to make it up. So what are those other fibre sources that we're going to need to help us to replace the dominance that polyester has in the market?
For somewhere like Australia, where we obviously grow a lot of wheat and grains, do you think these forms of cellulose fibres could be something we could really utilise?
That's a possibility. We have the wet spinning capability at Deakin University to actually make these fibres. So that definitely research could occur in Australia to understand what is the ability for Australian materials to go down this path. I'm in the Western District of Victoria, and the amount of cropping that occurs around me here, there's huge potential for sources for cellulose, and definitely it's something that's going to be needed in the future.
Associate Professor Chris Hurren from Deakin University's Institute for Frontier Materials, ending that report from Liam McNally. Up next, a trial that's been a bit successful to kill off an invasive cactus.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on your radio, online, and on the ABC Listen app.
So the invasive cactus is threatening Australia's and arid regions, and the trial to kill it off has been a major success, according to the project lead. So Weed Management Officer Gerald Danow says efforts to eradicate coral cactus in the Northern Territory have been more successful than he could have ever hoped, and that cactus is also found in Queensland and New South Wales and in Western Australia too. He tells Fiona Broom that the biological cactus control method could now go international.
Coral cactus is an invasive weed that threatens biodiversity, pastoral land, and native flora and fauna of the arid regions of Australia. Coral cactus was brought here in the 1900s. It was supposed to be used as a host for a cochineal production. Now, cochineal bugs is that red thing usually used for food dye. Apparently, that industry didn't push through, and now the host plant of that bug has become an invasive weed. This coral cactus forms dense, impenetrable, and spiny growth, making them hard to control both mechanically and chemically. These traditional control measures are found to be very expensive and unsustainable. And here, a more ecological solution is needed.
What does it look like? And if you look at a landscape in an arid area, would you spot this cactus?
Yes, it's easily spotted. These cacti are also called the rope cacti because they look like ropes. They're also green and so spiny, and all kangaroos, wallabies. I mean, I was pricked many times. It's just so painful. Just imagine with other animals.
And for livestock, I imagine it's not something that livestock want to eat, but does it take over pastoral areas?
Yes, they do. That's why the project that we did actually is the use of cholla bugs, a biocontrol agent. This is a cochineal insect. They look like mealybugs that attacks only the targeted coral cacti. In August last year, the first population of the cholla bugs was released in the NT, and it was in Tennant Creek. Yeah, we chose two locations. The first one is Singleton Station. It is a cattle station with a thriving population of coral cacti shaded among trees. And the second one is a landmine, an open area. So what we did is just like two opposite situations. One is an open area and the other one is a shaded area. And we found out that cholla bugs really had to be in a shaded area before, during the first release, for them to establish easier. Within 3 months, few meters away from the release site, we found establishment of the cholla bug infesting the coral cacti. Within 6 months, 50% within 24 meters around the release site, we found infestation. So it has increased. Within 9 months, 95% within an 89-meter radius from the release site, we found infestation, and 75% of the coral cacti are found dead. And it's just amazing, yeah.
And so are the bugs eating the plants, or they're bringing along a pathogen or a disease that infects the cactus?
These bugs, similar to mealybugs and other real bugs or the true bugs, they suck dry the coral cacti, leaving them some bruises. Those bruises make the cacti prone to secondary infection, like from bacteria, fungi, as well as viruses and other insects to feed onto. So what happens is that after they're being sucked dry, that weakens the plant, then a secondary infestation, oh dear, they're going to die. The plant's going to die.
Is there anything you then need to do after the cactus is dead? Will it need to be dug up then, or you can leave it and over time it will essentially disappear?
Yeah, the cacti will just die and degrade, be part of the soil, and there is no residual effect from chemicals being used. Yeah, there are three lessons that actually we saw from this project. Now, the first is that it is possible to control 75 to 95% of a single weed population using just a single control measure, not to mention a single insect. That's very significant. Number two is that tremendous reduction of the use of chemical, but it still worked. Now, this benefited the native wildlife population in that site. And the third one is that there certainly was an ecological or ecosystem restoration that happened in an area in the middle of Australia, which is supposed to be hard, laborious, and quite expensive to do the job.
Is there any risk of those bugs becoming an invasive problem? We have a history of this in Australia where we introduce one thing to counteract another thing that's been introduced.
Before this was being released, before the cholla bugs were being released, they have been tested and also released in the field, both in Queensland and New South Wales. And they are found to be safe, cost-effective, and scalable.
Gerald Deneau from the Northern Territory Weed Management Branch speaking with Fiona Broome. Let's head to the Dolby cattle sale where Trevor Hess has the details.
The first sale in the new financial year at Dolby saw numbers reduced by 688 head to 4,638. Export buyer attendance was good, and once again this week, southern exporters provided the most strength across the bullocks and cows. Heavyweight yielding steers to feed at the time of this interim report have averaged 4 cents better. A lift in the standard of the medium and heavyweight yielding heifers to feed resulted in a noticeable rise in price. Bullocks sold to strong competition, heavy grown heifers sold to a dearer trend. Cows continued to rise in price to average 3 to 6 cents better. Heavyweight yielding steers to feed made to 422 to average 385. Heavyweight yielding heifers to feed made to 396 to average 321. Heavy grown heifers to export processors made to 380. And heavyweight PTIC cows sold to restockers at a top of 323, some returning $2,094 a head. Heavyweight three-score cows to processors averaged 297. The best of the heavyweight cows made to 344 to average 319. This has been Trevor Hess from MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Over to the Tartars Towers Selling Centre now with Mick Kingham.
Good afternoon. Numbers remain similar to last week, with 2012 cattle penned in a prime-only sale. Quality was mixed, comprising of many small mixed lines of bullocks and bulls. However, the penning of nearly 1,100 cows was very good, with several heavyweight pens on offer. Most of the regular buyers were in attendance and operating, supported by one southern processor and one live exporter. However, one recent feeder buyer was absent. Cattle were drawn from Mount Isa and Camarwheel in the west, south of the Ballyandow and local area. Demand improved as the sale progressed, particularly heavyweight cows and bulls. Prices for bullocks were variable, settling according to quality, finishing firm to 10 cents easier. Heifers lifted 18 to 27 cents. Cows averaged firm to 4 cents better, and heavy bulls lifted by up to 6 cents a kilo. Grown steers above 400 kilos to processors averaged 272. Heavyweight grown steers to live export made 286. A good supply of grown heifers sold to firm demand, reaching 288, averaging from 261 to 270. Heavy bullocks to export slaughter topped at 292, averaging from 275 to 284, while those bullocks suitable for live export averaged 269. Medium weight 2-score cows to processors, sold to 234. 3 scores made to 280, to average from 242 to 254. And a large sample of prime heavyweight 3- and 4-score cows, topped at 270, to average from 258 to 260. Heavy bulls returned to the paddock, sold to 322. Most processor bulls made from 270 to 276. This is Mick Kingham from Charles Towers for the National Livestock Reporting Service.
Now, there's not going to be a grey smear sale on the Country Hour today. I've been told that there will be one for tomorrow morning, though, for the Rural Report, and that is for our Western, Central and Southern Queensland listeners. Make sure you tune in to your local ABC radio from 6:15 a.m. tomorrow morning. And also from tomorrow, it is ABC Queensland Gives Day, and tomorrow we're inviting you to help Queensland farmers and communities recover through the work of rural aid as part of ABC Queensland Gives. So make sure you tune in then. And then from 6:30 tomorrow night, ABC Radio Queensland's Kelly Higgins-Devine and Adam Stephen will host a special Rock the Recovery concert. That's all we have time for on the Country Hour today, though. My name's Megan Hughes. News is up next. It's 1 o'clock.